D News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. We begin today's morning show with the rebroadcast of a conversation from the morning show archives, an interview from almost a decade ago, but a very, very timely interview indeed. We also want to remind you that support for WGTD in the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology, online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. Here's part one of today's morning show from the archives.
I read a great many great books in this line of work, but I have to single out this current book for very exceptional praise. The book is Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, Why Violence Erupts in Close-Knit Communities and What Can Be Done to Stop It, authored by Catherine Newman. And this book, of course, is so timely in a terrible way, not because we have recently experienced this kind of rampage school shooting, but because just in the last 24 hours or so, new information has emerged from the incident in Littleton, Colorado, involving Columbine High School. And it raises the question once again of how it was that the warning signs given time and time again by the two young men who engaged in that rampage, how those warning signs were missed over and over again. That is just part of the story told in this extraordinary book written by Catherine Newman, who is at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and Dean of Social Science at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies. And we welcome you, Catherine Newman, to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Give us, if you would, a sense of how you were inspired to write a book that would examine this phenomenon of violence erupting in small communities. What drew you to this question in the first place?
Actually, Congress drew me to this study. The United States Congress passed a bill in 1999, the Missing, Runaway, and Exploited Children's Act, which actually mandated this research project, and they turned to the National Academy of Sciences, which in turn contacted me and a number of other researchers to begin to investigate why these things happen and what their consequences are in the communities where they occur. I had not initially thought of doing a project on this, but once I was approached, I found it such a compelling series of puzzles and tragedies that I couldn't leave it alone. It's a perfect opportunity for a social scientist to take her skills and use them in a way that will help to serve the society we live in, and that is a social responsibility for those of us with this training.
There are, unfortunately, all kinds of such incidents which you could have chosen to study in great detail. You chose incidents which occurred in Heath and Westside. What drew you to these particular incidents of school rampage shootings?
I had never done any serious research in the southern part of the United States, and I really wanted to learn more about that region of the country. It was the area that first gave rise to these rampage school shootings, although ultimately they spread to the west, to the northeast, and there is no real regional pattern anymore. But in the beginning, they began erupting in these small southern towns. And I was drawn to these two particular cases because they were among the most shocking and involved the youngest shooters on record in the case in the West Side School District, which is near Jonesboro, Arkansas. The shooters were 11 and 13 years old, and as a mother of teenagers myself, I really wanted to understand what could drive young boys to do something so horrible in the very community that had embraced them growing up. So it was a series of puzzles that I think captured the attention and grief of the nation, and that is the kind of problem that I have always been engaged in studying as a social scientist.
So we are looking at incidents incurred in Westside, Arkansas, and Heath, Kentucky. You came to these two communities, if I remember correctly, 2 or 3 years after the fact.
That's right.
Tell us briefly, if you would, how you went about that. I ask that because one of the most interesting passages in the book is when you talk about how these two communities were, in effect, besieged by media.
Yes.
In the wake of these terrible incidents, as I'm sure was the case in other locations as well. And you also talk in fascinating fashion about how all these communities were also, both of these were overwhelmed by support and best wishes and gifts in a way which almost swamped them and became a problem in and of itself.
That's
given your
true
sensitivity to that, how did you and your research team enter these two communities mindful of those kind of problems which had gone on before?
Well, with great difficulty. There was initially enormous resistance to our presence, which was very understandable because there was a kind of second assault in both places that stemmed from this media invasion. Within about an hour of these shootings, 200, you know, media trucks showed up at the school settings, and reporters were very aggressive about going after kids for interviews. And these were very young children, many of them, and quite traumatized. And so the communities really, which were quite insular and very small towns and not at all accustomed to the Klieg lights, were just horrified in the worst moments of their entire history. They had to contend with this exposure to the outside world. So I was aware that this was going to create resistance, and it was very understandable. Also, having to backtrack over the most grief-stricken territory in their histories is not something anybody enjoys doing very much. Many people, understandably, just wanted to get past this. And the idea of opening it up all over again 3 years later was not very appetizing. However, we were fortunate in two respects. First, the interest of Congress in this problem did cause the community to have a more positive reaction. That is, they thought of this then as a civic obligation, having been called upon by the highest authorities in the land to help understand why these things happened in the name of trying to prevent it elsewhere. Second, I was very fortunate in that our affiliation with a distinguished university, which most people recognize the name of Harvard, really did help, I think, because they understood that we were legitimate and serious researchers rather than fly-by-night, gossip columnists or something of that kind.
Or yes, not trying to profit from this experience in any way,
in
shape,
fact,
or form.
Our awareness of how sensitive this issue was prompted our discussions, my co-authors and I, very early on, that all proceeds that we would have been given for this book are going to the two schools. So we've donated all of the author royalties to the two schools. We did not want them to think for a moment that our purpose was in any way mercenary. It really is educational and civic.
You mentioned one other problem which made this difficult, not only their understandable reluctance and maybe lack of receptiveness to being a part of this kind of study of something so painful. But you also mentioned the complicating factor of conflicting accounts.
Yes.
How does one come to terms with that sort of logistical challenge in undertaking a study?
It's very complicated. What we tried to do was to understand not only what we were being told, but the vantage point of each observer, and to try and understand, in a sense, what their stake might be in a particular rendition of these events. And sometimes that stake was, understandably, claiming some attention for themselves. Sometimes there was a guilt factor. It was very, very hard for the kids in the community who had heard these threats or seen hit lists and did not come forward to accept the idea that they were not blameworthy. They really did blame themselves, and some of them have been in mental health treatment for, you know, years after these shootings because they do feel responsible for something that really was not their fault. So we tried to understand how guilt might play a role, how, you know, attention-seeking might play a role, how each person we spoke to had only a partial vantage point, and what would that vantage point have opened up to them, and what would it have foreclosed to them. So every piece of evidence we had was subjected to multiple forms of analysis that began with what do we know about the vantage point of this person, and how would that affect what they have to say. And then we tried to reconcile these accounts, and sometimes in the book we present what we think really happened, and sometimes we present what different parties think happened because the differences between them are in some ways as instructive as the single truth.
And of course, complicating all of this is the fact that certain people, rightly or wrongly, do feel some sense of guilt or responsibility in perhaps having unwittingly allowed this to happen. And that has to weigh sometimes in the way people consciously or unconsciously look at events and talk about them.
That's right.
We're speaking with Catherine Newman, author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. You take great pains in this book to explain this kind of phenomenon, how it is similar and how it is different from other kinds of violence involving young people. That, for instance, violence erupts all the time in urban settings, in urban schools, but not in this same sort of way. Give us what sets the most important things which set these kind of incidents apart from this other kind of maybe more common violence among young people.
Right. There are very big differences between these rampage school shootings and other kinds of violence. First of all, in cities, schools are probably the safest place adolescents can be. That doesn't mean that cities are always safe, but violence, especially this kind of violence, tends not to happen in schools. It'll happen on the streets. It'll happen in gang settings, but not in the schools. There hasn't been a school shooting in New York City since 1992, and it was a shock when that happened because it was very rare. Of course, that's a city that had plenty of violence on the streets. So why would that be the case? Well, what we reasoned in the book was that what adolescents are trying to do often with this violence is to make a point about their social, the way the community perceives them, to change their reputation. In small rural communities, the school is often the most important public stage where reputation is made and unmade. But in big cities, schools are actually not that important to adolescents as a stage for reputation building. The streets are much more important. So what's critical here is, what are these shooters trying to accomplish? If what they're trying to accomplish is reversing their reputation, that reversal will happen in the most effective and prominent public stage. And in rural communities, the school is really the only integrating institution around.
You mentioned
the really small towns, there are no streets.
Exactly. And you mentioned the fact that it is not only that central stage for the young people where it's their own school, but the whole community gathers around the school and focuses on the school and what occurs there in a way that it simply cannot happen in New York City or Detroit, Michigan, or in
exactly
an urban
right.
setting like
and
that.
And in fact, one of the reasons why these shootings happen in these small towns is that young boys who feel that they're social failures are failures in all directions. There is no separation for them between the school, the neighborhood, the community, the scouting, the baseball. It's all one place and all one set of people, and they all interlock so that if you are failing in the eyes of your peer group, it's known by everyone. There isn't some other domain you can hide in. And it's those overlapping ties, or what we call social capital, that makes small towns both virtuous places to live, where everyone really does know your name, and difficult places to live if you're not succeeding because you can't hide anywhere.
Yes,
in a city, you can get on the subway and go down to Greenwich Village and be a different kind of person, but there isn't a Greenwich Village anywhere near Jonesboro, Arkansas, and that intensifies the feelings of failure among those kids who aren't succeeding socially.
You mentioned the fact that those who tend to be the targets of of these kind of rampage shootings are often largely random, or such an incident might begin with a disgruntled student or disturbed student targeting a particular teacher or principal, but then it often will spill over into almost random shooting.
That's exactly right, and that's what differentiates this kind of shooting from a revenge killing, which is more common in an urban setting. These are not revenge killings. Usually the shooters don't even know who they've killed until long after the fact. They're aiming at a group, or they're aiming at an institution, a school that they feel in general has put them down, but not at particular individuals. So they take out a gun and spray a crowd, but they don't know who they've killed. And that, I think, is one of the most distressing aspects of these shootings for the country. Random behavior always troubles us. If we can figure out a pattern and figure out a pathway of causes, well, we're a little bit comforted by that because we can try and address the problem. But if it's random, then what do we do?
Well, and
it's much more frightening.
Yes,
to us.
It could happen to anyone. It has nothing to do with, well, I won't go to bars anymore,
exactly,
then, or I won't go to the rodeo anymore. I mean, this is something that could intersect with anybody's life. You say at one point, rampage shootings terrify us because they contradict our most firmly held beliefs about childhood, home, and community. They expose the vulnerable underbelly of ordinary life and tell us that malevolence can be brewing in places where we least expect it.
That's right.
You examined in great detail the three young men involved in these two incidents of violence. And, of course, one of the things that emerges is this phenomenon of warning signs, of certain patterns of behavior. But these were dots that were not connected in time for these incidents to be stopped. And you explain a number of different reasons why that occurs, particularly within schools, and the way often schools are set up so that information is not effectively shared. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yes, I got very interested in this puzzle, that there was so much information circulating, so many threats that we could document had been issued in semi-public settings. How was it that no adults knew what was coming when the kids didn't even have to be told? When they realized the shooting had happened, they knew instantly who it was before the person was even captured. How could that be? And there are a couple of reasons. First, the threats that are circulating are known to teenage peers, but for a variety of reasons we explain in the book, they don't come, or they didn't, before Columbine anyway, they didn't come forward to tell any adults. There are a series of reasons why they don't come forward, and so that source of information doesn't get into adult hands. In the schools in general, though, there are other aspects of the organization of schools that prevent information from circulating as it might. For example, when kids pass from junior high school or middle school to high school, their disciplinary records don't follow them. The disciplinary records are shredded. Now, there are virtuous reasons why that happens. We don't want ninth grade teachers to expect failures from their incoming students because they had a bad year in eighth grade. Kids might have a bad year. You want them to be able to recover the next year. So you don't attach these disciplinary records and forward them. And hence, when the kids entered ninth grade, as Michael Carneal did in the Kentucky case, he'd only been in that school for less than 90 days when the shooting happened. The teachers had no idea what he'd been through in eighth grade, no idea that this student with a very high IQ had seen his grades plummet down to a D average, had been through some horrible harassment incidents. And so when he came to high school and engaged in a few little remarkable misbehaviors that might have drawn a different kind of attention if they could have seen a pattern, they couldn't see a pattern because the information wasn't there anymore. The organization of the school day also affects this. These teachers are seeing their students for 50 minutes a day, and then they pass them on to the next teacher. So one teacher gets an essay that's troubling, but she doesn't see this kid all day long. And no one ever collects that information to see a pattern of their behavior throughout the day or throughout the year. Mm.
You mentioned at least one incident in which a teacher saw one of these young men do something, I think in biology class, and never documented it. Because, of course, there aren't enough hours in the day to document every single incident. But if one doesn't leave a paper trail behind of one kind or another, document it one way or another, then that's the kind of incident which can't possibly be helpful to
that's
other
true,
teachers.
But it's not just the hours in the day, although that is part of it. We endow teachers with a certain amount of autonomy because they're professionals. We don't regulate every move they make in the classroom. They make their own decisions about certain kinds of curricula and often, ironically, about disciplinary practices. So if a kid like Michael takes a fish out of a fish tank and stomps it into the floor, there is no rule book that says that teacher must write this up as an infraction. The teacher may just sort of make a mental note of this and say, you know, Michael, go stand in the corner. But there is no central place where that information is kept. And so if Michael is doing these things in different settings with different teachers, the whole pattern doesn't emerge in anybody's hands.
Right. You also mentioned the fact that if a student is not very specifically violating a certain code of behavior, which would set in motion certain official documentation, for instance, then there isn't always the means to make note of other kinds of troubling behavior.
That's exactly right, and it helps to explain why teachers are so puzzled when the identity of these shooters is finally revealed, because they will say, you know, there were 50 other kids I might have expected this of before I would have gotten to this kid. This kid was the one who always said, yes, ma'am, no, sir, holds the door open for a teacher as she's passing through, you know, invariably apologized whenever they did do anything wrong. They can point to kids, other kids, who have been egregious violators of school rules, and they might well have expected that kind of kid to explode. But school shooters typically aren't like that. They're flying right below that radar screen, and so the pattern in their behavior isn't as outlandish and extreme. Extreme behavior does call down the sanctions the school has available, but that's not who does school shootings.
You know, this all of a sudden clarifies for me something earlier in the book when you contrast urban shootings with these rampage shootings in rural and suburban areas. When you say that typically those urban incidents of violence, a young person is confirming their label.
Mm-hmm.
They are confirming what society says they are or have been up to that point, whereas these rampage shootings involve young people who are trying to defy the labels that
That's
have been
right.
placed on them.
They're trying to reverse a reputation.
Right, of perhaps being very polite and very scared or,
right. or not sufficiently masculine, not successful at sports, not notorious, not respected. They're trying to defy that label.
And so that's part of what makes this so surprising then.
Yes.
If one is too drawn to the labels and to the surface identity of certain young people, we just don't see what might be underneath the surface contradicting that label. We need to talk about what is in some ways even more interesting, which is how these very close-knit communities, where everybody knows everybody and everything about everybody else, how it can be then that these kind of disturbing incidents can go undiscussed. What did you discover about that?
We discovered something very counterintuitive, I think. We tend to think of small-town America, and rightly so, as a place where everybody hangs together so tightly that misbehavior just couldn't escape people's attention. But in fact, what happens in these communities is that the social relations between generations and among adults are so tight and so important and so durable that the prospect of any rupture in them is really very troubling, much more so than in a city where your neighbor probably isn't your teacher and may not be your scout leader or your best friend or somebody you grew up with. But in these small towns, those relations may be exactly as multiplex as that. And so the cost of losing a friend is so serious that we found parents were extremely reticent about coming forward with really troubling, damaging information about the misbehavior of a child. So one of the shooters in the Jonesboro case, who had a reputation for killing cats, for threatening kids in the neighborhood, nobody ever came forward to his parents and said, you know, Andrew is causing a lot of trouble here and you should really look into this. Instead, what they said was to their kids, don't play with Andrew. because they wanted to preserve their social relations with Andrew's parents, who were beloved by the community, long-standing residents, several generations deep. So ironically, in precisely the kind of place where everybody knows your name, damaging information is likely to be withheld rather than shared, or at least rather than shared with people who might have been able to take steps to intervene. Because the cost of losing those friendships is so high, you can't just pick up and decide you're going to move into a different friendship circle. There isn't any other friendship circle if you live in a place that's 5 hours from the nearest city, where the whole community has only 200 houses in it. This is it for you.
Right. And, well, and you
so
mentioned...
You hold back rather than come forward.
Sure. You mentioned the fact at one point that if neighbor X is likely to be your neighbor for the next 25 years, well, then at least some people treat that neighbor in a very special way, interact with them in a very careful way, mindful of the fact that I want there to be a positive relationship there, and to share these kind of disturbing observations about a person's child, that can be, as you say, exceedingly difficult.
Very threatening.
Mm. You mentioned the fact also that other students are not as forthcoming as we might hope them to be. They often would be privy to these warning signs given well before the fact. And you say that school administrators and other adults in all kinds of different ways have a way of discouraging students from sharing this kind of information. Is it for kind of the same reason?
No, it's a slightly different set of reasons. teachers and administrators, especially in middle schools and then going on into high schools, have a task before them, which is to help kids grow up. How are they going to do that? Well, they have to insist on a certain degree of autonomy for those kids. They have to, their parents can't be solving every problem for them or they won't learn to grow up. And so a philosophy develops out of that view that part of the school's task is to help kids learn to become adults, that when kids come to them with problems, they may sometimes say, you know, you should solve that yourself, or, you know, this is really your responsibility. You should go and work this out. And although there is this virtuous reason for that view, which in some ways we all subscribe to, that kids need to grow up, the consequence for the kid is that he thinks, they're not taking me seriously. If I come forward with this information, they're not going to act on it. They don't really care about my problem. And in fact, these kids who come forward with stories about being bullied will frequently be told, look, you've got to solve this yourself.
Or don't be so sensitive.
Or don't be so sensitive.
Or what did you do to bring this on?
Yeah, so the message that comes back to the kid is these adults say that they're going to be responsive, but actually they're not.
Hmm.
Or there can be other reasons. The kid thinks that if the school is responsive, it won't keep the information confidential. So if it, you know, and they can cite chapter and verse of instances where they have come forward and it was known all over town within an hour that they were the source of this information.
Mm.
Now, that is not always the school's fault. Sometimes if an individual kid comes forward where he's the only person who could know this information, then if they act on it, it becomes obvious who came forward only because they were the only person who could be privy to it.
Right. And
but
in these...
what the kid concludes out of this is, my confidentiality is not going to be protected here. I'm going to be exposed for offering this information.
Mm.
Now, if the kids really are sure that what they've heard is a threat of murder, they will take that risk. But if we look carefully at what kind of information they have, it's almost never that certain. It's confusing. It's noisy signals. So if Michael Carneal says, you'll see who lives or dies on Monday, and the kids don't know what that really means. I mean, it sounds threatening, but they don't really know that that means he's going to come to school and shoot people, especially before Columbine, when this was really an unthinkable scenario. They don't come forward in a risky social situation with information that's so ambiguous that they don't really entirely know what they've heard.
Right, and which could seem foolish on the surface.
Well, it seems outlandish.
Yes.
And, of course, people like these school shooters are often known for being people who say outlandish things. So it becomes one more outlandish thing that jerky kid Michael Carneal has said. if Michael had been the kind of person who never said that sort of thing and all of a sudden came out with it, it might have registered in a different way. But frequently these are kids who've been seeking attention and are known for making loose cannon threats that they don't follow through on. Now, that's precisely the bind, then, that the school shooter finds himself in. He's trying to reverse his reputation. He's trying to get people to think he's notorious and dangerous. He starts to make public pronouncements, and then he has to follow through, because to default on following through is to risk one more huge failure. And that is precisely what happened in the Kentucky case. When Carneal came to school that Monday morning, I'm fairly convinced he didn't intend to shoot people. But he showed the goth group he was trying to impress this collection of guns, and they didn't pay any attention to him. They just ignored him. And he thought to himself, and we know this from his psychiatric testimony, if I don't do this, they're going to hate me even more than they do now. And he pushed himself then over that threshold and killed three kids. But having made those public pronouncements, they're now committed to a strategy of action, which to default on it is just to confirm what failures they are.
Sad, terrible stories, and a very important cautionary tale in your book called Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings by Catherine Newman, published by Basic Books. Catherine Newman, I thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show for writing this extraordinary book.
Thank you so much for your interest.
The time is 8:41 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. This book, Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings, was released in paperback back in the spring of 2005. Now part two of today's morning show, also from the archives, but a much more recent book, and a book that is also in sort of a different sort of way, very timely for this topic that is dominating so many of our thoughts and reflections as a nation. This is The Morning Show on WGTD, and now part two. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I'm going to be privileged to speak with Dr. Steven Pinker, who is the Johnstone Professor of Psychology at Harvard University and the author of a number of highly regarded books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, and The Blank Slate. In this particular case, we're going to be talking about Professor Pinker's book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It is Professor Pinker's contention that even amidst the headlines which trumpet violent acts each and every day, we in fact live in a world that is much less violent than it once was. And in his sprawling book, almost 700 pages long, Professor Pinker lays out a number of different respects in which violence, in fact, has declined over the millennia, over the course of centuries, and over the course of recent decades as well. Violence as it plays out in a number of different respects on larger canvases between countries and on a smaller, more intimate scale between individuals. In almost every respect, violence has been declining in dramatic ways. And he sees this as not a reason to be complacent, but as a cause for hope that we have accomplished so much in terms of reducing violence, and we can do still better to make our world an even more peaceful place. The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, is now a paperback from Penguin Books. Professor Pinker, you say very early in the book that in raising the whole notion of us living in a less violent world than it once was, that this is an idea that invites skepticism, incredulity, and sometimes anger. Say a word about that, and maybe some actual experiences that you have had in stating this, in terms of how such a notion has been received, and what that has done to your firmness of conviction.
Yeah, there certainly has been incredulity. particularly in conversations with the news media, because it's just easy to say, well, what about the shooting that happened this morning, or the terrorist attack last week, or the bombing the week before? And I have to reply by saying, well, it's true that rates of violence have not gone down to zero. And as long as violence hasn't been wiped off the face of the earth, which I think will never happen, there'll always be enough events to fill the news. What you have to do is look back to how much violence there was in the past, and it's only when you do that that you appreciate something that the news could never show you, which is that the rates have come down, because news is about things that happen, not about things that don't happen. And if we don't count up the number of schools that have not been shot up, or the number of countries that are at peace, or the number of people who come home to their families and aren't mugged or shot or raped, then we can lose the bigger picture. So I have to counter people's simple disbelief that this could possibly be true by saying, look, I'm going to show you a graph, and you can see it with your own eyeballs. But until you look at the graph, if all you do is remember the headlines, then it can just seem unbelievable. There's also some anger, because people think that if you point out to things getting better, then you must be callous about the violence that's taking place now. But I argue that it's the opposite. If you are just resigned to the fact that rates of violence are always going to be the same, that human nature doesn't allow us to lower violence, then you can say, well, why even bother? People will just kill each other no matter what you do. And I try to hold out the fact that violence has gone down as a reason to try to drive it down even farther. That, and to my own surprise, actually, when I came across these data, you know, in the 1960s, there were folk songs saying, I had a dream that the world put an end to war. And it's easy to laugh at that and think, oh, that's just kind of romantic haze from taking too many mind-altering drugs in the 60s and too much love and peace and folk songs. But then when you look at the numbers and you see that wars between countries really have been going down, and it's actually not a crazy dream to think that war in the old-fashioned sense of country A declaring war against country B could be eliminated in the same way that we've eliminated slave auctions and dueling and crucifixions and all kinds of awful stuff that people thought would always be with us. So that's how I counter the anger that if you say that violence has gone down, that means that you're indifferent to the violence that still takes place.
Right. You say at one point in the book that this topic has inspired, in your words, too much piety and not enough understanding. What would be some of the ways in which this has been most true and in your view, least beneficial?
Yes. Certainly giving huge coverage in the news to a particular event, a terrorist attack, a police shooting, and not putting it in the perspective of trends in the past, of reminding people of the horrific wars that they tend to forget. I mean, does anyone talk about the war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s, or the Chinese Civil War, or even the war in Vietnam, which is about 10 times as damaging as the war in Iraq? I think it is crucial to look at the numbers and to say, what has gone right? Let's figure out what has worked. Let's try to do more of it.
I think that's what you're talking about when you say that one thing is that what we need to do in approaching this is with an unsentimental sense of history and with statistical literacy. And, of course, that's a couple of things that not all of us are all that good at.
Yeah, it's for two reasons. One of them is just in terms of emotional energy. Is it even worth it to try to eliminate war, to try to reduce the threat from nuclear weapons, to try to make the streets safer? Or are you just being a romantic or a utopian? If you read the papers, you might think, oh, why even bother? It's just throwing money down a rat hole. People are going to kill each other no matter what you do. And that's wrong. It's just an incorrect belief. And then the other is how, what works, what doesn't work. And that, of course, is the most moral thing to do, is you prevent people from getting killed and raped and assaulted and maimed. And that's why there's a moral imperative to understand.
You really help us take in this notion of us living in a less violent world by spelling it out in a number of different ways, including six different trends of de-escalating violence. And could you just touch on these? Because I think in just doing so, our listeners will have at least a notion of just how thoroughly you are exploring this question.
Yeah, it's important to separate out different kinds of violence, because they really did go down on different timelines. And you can get, it's easy to get confused if you don't keep track of the different categories, because war isn't the same thing as a stabbing in a bar. And you look at, say, World War II, which was the most violent event in history, and you say, well, the 20th century must have been the most violent century ever. And that isn't right, because in general, more people are killed in homicides than in wars, and the rate of homicide has been going down since the Middle Ages in parts of the world where we have continuous data. War really only started to go down after World War II. Before that, there were fewer wars, but the wars that did take place killed more people, so the world wasn't actually getting better. But in the last 72 years, we've seen the trend go down for war much more recently. Then a third category was violence that was allowed by law. Slavery, for example, where if a slave escaped, the government would help round him up and bring him back. Capital punishment for shoplifting or for poaching or for counterfeiting. The government was the one killing people. And starting around the Enlightenment, the late 18th century, at the time of the Bill of Rights of our own country, then you started to see red lines that governments couldn't cross. Governments couldn't cut off body parts or torture people. It took a little bit longer to abolish slavery, but the abolitionist movement began in the late 18th century. So that's yet a third timeline. I call it the humanitarian revolution, and that gets its own chapter in the book, separate from the chapters on war and on homicide.
So there are a number of different ways in which violence has actually decreased over the centuries, over the millennia. Your book also explores some of the reasons for this, and in doing so, you explore some of the demons which tend to drive violent behavior, but also what you call the four better angels of our nature, quoting, of course, our 16th president. Touch on what those are and the kind of difference those have made.
Yes, the better angels of our nature, which is a lovely poetic description of brain science and psychology, namely parts of human nature that pull us back from violence, include empathy, that is the ability to feel others' pain and to think about what it must be like in their shoes, but also self-control, since a lot of violence is impulsive. The anger wells up and you just have to act on it, but pushing back against that is the part of the brain that makes you think twice and hold your horses and count to 10. Then there's also reason, rationality, thinking. That is, of all of the policies that we could implement, which are the ones that could actually do the most good, that could reduce the murder rate, reduce the likelihood of getting into a war? And so you can calculate your way to a better world as well.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, and what I think has changed over the course of history is not that we've become a nicer species. Evolution doesn't work that quickly. We're still the same people biologically that we were 70 years ago and 100 years ago and 500 years ago. But we've changed the rules of society so that the better angels of our nature are more influential.
So why is it, and is it true, but if it, I mean, I think it's true that when violence occurs, when it does break out, even if it is statistically less frequent, why does it seem to have such enormous impact and resonance with us? And is that the way it should be? I mean, are we overreacting to the violence that does exist in our world?
Yes and no. Part of the reason that violence has gone down is that we care more about categories of victims of violence that we didn't care about in the past. Violence against racial minorities, wars in parts of the world that it's easy for us to forget about in Africa, in the Middle East, in the Far East. Just as a simple example, the fact that bullying is now a major category of violence, that would have been unthinkable when I was a boy. Bullying was just a part of childhood, and you'd be a sissy to worry about it. Now we legitimately think about what it's like to be a child who is constantly picked on. So that is good. On the other hand, if violence is covered indiscriminately, then that kind of creates an opportunity for violence entrepreneurs to kind of game the system and to manipulate the news media, which is a bad thing. And the two categories where that happens are terrorism, where terrorism doesn't really kill a whole lot of people, but it is a media manipulation tactic. It's a way that people with a grievance can get the world's attention by killing a few innocent people in a spectacular way, and then they get the world's attention. And something is similar probably for rampage shooters, for the guy who gets a gun and shoots up a school or a movie theater or a sports playing field. Not a whole lot of deaths, but because there's wall-to-wall coverage, it actually creates an incentive for those people to get the world's attention.
One of the most striking sentences in your whole book is when you say, "Nostalgia for a peaceable past is the biggest delusion of all in which we can engage." And that's a way for you to segue into, I think, one of the most important points in your book, which is that if we can accept this amazing notion that we live in a less violent world than we once did, that also makes it possible for us to embrace modernity, this modern world, this modern life, in the face of what is often very easy criticism and lazy criticism that can be lodged against it.
Indeed. We have to think back to the world in which countries competed against each other and went to war over national greatness, which killed people by the tens of millions, and not get distracted by acts of terrorism, which kill people three or four at a time.
Your book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It is a New York Times bestseller, now available in paperback from Penguin Books, the author, Steven Pinker. Professor Pinker, thank you so much for this opportunity for me to speak with you about your endlessly fascinating book.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
It is 8:58, and you're listening to WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm excited to tell you about the rest of the week on The Morning Show. Tomorrow, and once again from the archives, I will be replaying a conversation with Kyle Cassidy, author of an interesting sort of coffee table book called Armed America, Portraits of Gun Owners in Their Homes. Cassidy traveled throughout the country to photograph a wide variety of gun owners in their homes with their guns in an effort to explore and highlight the wide range of gun ownership in our country. It is an interesting book, and it's an interesting conversation that I will replay tomorrow. On Wednesday, the last day of Black History Month, I will replay my conversation with Isabel Wilkerson, author of a stunning book called The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Wilkerson's award-winning book explores the massive migration of Black Americans out of the South into other parts of the country in the late 19th and early 20th century. On Thursday, March 1st, from the archives, once again, John M. Barry's definitive book about the great flu pandemic of 100 years ago. His book is called The Great Influenza. We're replaying this as part of the Big Read Project, since the book that they chose, Station 11, involves a catastrophic flu pandemic. Finally, on Friday, a new interview about a new book, Carolyn Fraser, and a book sure to be a definitive biography of